And this is Glenn Falkenstein and Chris Evans, and we have magically moved from the 2SCR studio to the Chevelle Cinema in Paddington.
The Jameson's getting to our heads.
Yeah, we've been at the opening night of the Irish Film Festival. We've had a few Guinnesses each. We've had a wonderful time. If you hear music in the background, we hope you do. It is the beautiful band playing in the Chevelle space, and we're having a bit of trouble getting our Jameson bottles open. I got mine. We've got to work with Chris's during this, but it's so great. It's the most wonderful night. It is the first night of the festival at the Chevelle, and it has four more through to Sunday, and we have seen the first film of the festival, which is Maze. Maze is a drama based on the 1983 breakout of a prison in Northern Ireland, and it was a historical drama, but it's also, what I found really interesting about it, was a microcosm of the conflict in general and was a great commentary on what was happening at the time. It takes place following the famous hunger strikes, which should be dramatized in a number of films, some of which have been most famously in Hunger, and some of which have actually played at the festival before. But Maze, I found, was very interesting and evoked a lot of the interesting films like The Last Castle, many of the famous Prison Break films, but was much grittier and more realistic in that it was dealing with a very prescient and serious event, but I think was very faithful in its retelling as well.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it's a very routine film. It feels a lot like many classic Prison Break films you've seen before, but it's quite well handled. I think the main drama between the prison warden that Larry Morley was his name?
Yes.
Yeah, that Larry Morley ends up using to further the plot is well sketched, and the film takes its time to develop that and build up tension before the actual breakout. I thought it's not an extraordinary film by any means, but it's well handled, entertaining, well put together. I'd recommend you seek it out if you're interested in the subject matter, for sure.
I think so too. It's one of the only two films playing, the only film playing twice at this year's Irish Film Festival. Interestingly, we were training to Trevor Burney, who we're going to be talking to later in this program and later in the weekend. As you might be able to tell, we were recording this throughout the festival, a special festival coverage. It is one of the most interesting and amazing festivals in Sydney. This is its fourth year, and I've been fortunate enough to see it at the Chevelle each year, and each year it has grown and grown, and it is in large part due to the amazing work of the volunteers and the amazing festival director, Dr. Enda Murray. And to have a film like this screen at the opening night of the festival, we were chatting to Trevor, as I was saying, and he was explaining to us, among much discussion of what is happening in the sports world in Australia, that this film is doing incredibly well in Ireland and is quite popular and is getting quite the bit of buzz.
Mazes.
Yes, that's what I understand.
Right, interesting. Glenn just had to confiscate the Jameson from me as I continuously tried to crack it open, and as we speak, he just attempted to take over from me, and it's still not working.
It's really tough. Like, this is... Why? They make them so small, but they're so hard to open.
Yeah, the Guinness before the film worked a lot better than this. But no, it doesn't surprise me that Maze is making a big stir in Ireland, because it handles the issues pretty sensitively, I would say. Obviously our sympathies are with Larry, but it doesn't seem like a film that's extremely biased towards the Republican side.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, it's interesting that it takes place on a cell block where they forcibly put both the Republicans and the Loyalists. And there's one sequence where one of the more symbolic in the film, where members of both sides confront each other when the Loyalists are attempting to do a march. And there's actually, it was Trevor who pointed it out to me, that there's a couple of moments in the film like this, but there's where the main character, Larry, points out to the prison warden, sure, I'm in prison, but we kind of all are. And the extent to which it is analogous to so much of the troubles and so much of what is going on in Ireland. But I don't believe, and while many films have gone for this sort of move in terms of telling a historical story, I don't believe this was heavy-handed. I don't believe this was too pointed in trying to make this point. I think it handled it quite well. I don't think it did it at the expense of the drama.
Yeah, I agree with that. I never found it heavy-handed, despite it going into territory that it could easily become very preachy. It was pretty well focused on the characters, you know. That always came first. The drama came first, essentially. And Obviously, the focus is very much on these two men, but while it, you know, and there's not much focus on the surrounding characters, like their family, but when it did dip into that, it felt like it was well, you know, thought through and integrated into the drama. It wasn't just perfunctory as it tends to be in other films, like, oh, and they also have wives, so you should feel sympathetic for them. You know, it felt like that was always a lingering thing at the back of their minds that was motivating the action, you know, like, motivating what they did. What about my family, you know? I thought that was, yeah, well, integrated into the narrative, yeah.
No, I think those characters are very well drawn, and even the minor characters, one of whom, there's a few actresses and actors you'll recognize from various roles. The wife of the prison warder in this plays the police constable on The Fall, the excellent BBC series that was set and filmed in Northern Ireland, which is, we've talked about before on the show, is absolutely worth checking out. So we will be, as you can probably hear, enjoying some more Irish tunes. We'll be back talking about the many other amazing films that are playing at the festival, along with some interviews for our special Irish Film Festival coverage tomorrow. But you'll hear us, like, right away. We'll go anywhere. You just keep listening, and you'll hear it. We'll just magically be at Friday.
Yeah, keep listening. We'll try and give you the good stuff. Jameson's the good stuff.
Jameson is... It's so great. We're going to get that open.
One day.
We're here with Maurice Fitzpatrick, the director of In the Name of Peace, John Hume in America. Maurice, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Maurice, this is the second night of the Irish Film Festival. The film is screening tonight, and it is your first time in Sydney and Australia. How have you enjoyed your time here so far?
Oh, it's been fantastic. I landed with a thud yesterday evening, and I'm still acclimatizing in all sorts of ways, but greatly helped along the way by the warmth and hospitality of the people here. It's been going great.
Fantastic. Now, the film, it has its Australian premiere at the festival tonight. Can you tell us about your documentary?
Yeah, so the documentary focuses on the political life of John Hume, who was a leader for peace, a leader for civil rights, and for an advocate of new political structures in Northern Ireland. The most decisive and important political figure to have emerged out of Northern Ireland ever. He emerged in the late 1960s at a time of transformative change all over Europe, all over the world. And in some senses, the Northern Irish moment, Derry 1968, kind of was part of that wave of change, an embrace of a new and modern and inclusive politics, and Hume advocated that, became a civil rights leader, and ultimately then became a representative of his constituency, Derry City in the north of Ireland. So that's where he started, and that's indeed where my film largely starts. But we rapidly in the film move towards America, and here's the reason why. Hume did get elected first to the Parliament of Northern Ireland and later British Parliament and European Parliament. But he saw early on that the unionist system in the North was such that raw power was tremendous, raw power was needed to change the situation. And that would involve, of course, a change in mentality in Britain as well. The policymakers in Britain would need to accommodate the Irish dimension of the Northern Irish people, and would need to acknowledge that what had happened in the North could not continue, particularly in the face of a newly educated Northern Irish electorate that was aware of all the things that are happening around the world, like, you know, Selma to Montgomery March, Martin Luther King. So many liberation movements were happening, and they could see that they were deprived of civil rights at home and that there was no legitimate reason why they should be. So they're demanding change. And Hume saw that by creating a role for the United States, and particularly several senior political figures there, he could thereby and through them lean on even the most recalcitrant of pro-unionist British leaders, I'm thinking of Margaret Thatcher, into taking a more conciliatory view of the Northern Irish crisis.
Fantastic. And speaking of those US leaders, you have a number of very prominent US leaders in the film. And interestingly, you also chronicle one who has since passed on a race because we have the poster for Chappaquiddick sitting right next to us, which tells one aspect of the story of Ted Kennedy, but this tells a whole other and a fascinating chapter in his life too.
Senator Ted Kennedy was one of the most consistent supporters of a new politics in the north of Ireland. You've mentioned Chappaquiddick. I can see the poster in front of me, which is now, I suppose, dominating associations of his legacy. But as I started to look into this story, and of course my focus wasn't on Chappaquiddick, it was on Ireland and on policy and on resolutions being passed in Congress and on pressure being put on the White House, which naturally is the seat of foreign policy in the United States, I started to see very clearly quite how fundamental a role he played. And also his chief of staff, Kerry Parker, I mean, became notorious on Capitol Hill for knowing Irish affairs better than the Irish representatives themselves. He was quite a phenomenal person. And I'm going to circle back to the word education. There was a newly educated politics, a newly educated view of what could be done and what should be done regarding Northern Ireland. I mean, Teddy Kennedy's earliest pronouncements, which he later detracted, were pro-IRA. And that he quickly saw through his conversations with John Hume. One particular conversation, which is developed in the film a lot, he quickly saw that that was not the way to solve things. It was absolutely futile, leading nowhere. And Ted Kennedy soon became one of two, I would say, between he and Speaker Tip O'Neill, most prominent, dominant of the voices in the United States Congress advocating John Hume's position.
It's fascinating. And you also had a number of amazing interviews in the film. I'm very curious about going about those and interacting with some of these major world figures.
Well, interacting with some of the major world figures is a bit like interacting with John and Mary Soap. They're the same as us in many respects. And yet, of course, some of them are hugely talented people as well, and they've seen a lot. And it is, you know, I would circle into the two U.S. presidents, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, who appear in the film. It would have been so much easier to say foreign policy is all about, in Carter's administration, you know, Iran, China, Soviet Union. In the case of Clinton, you know, the Cold War and so on, the end of the Cold War and the new reality after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And yet, this tiny little windswept island, Ireland, became part of their agenda. Not more in the case of Clinton than in the case of Carter, but what was really crucial about Carter was that he was the first United States president to get explicitly involved, and involved in an irreversible way. The presidency of the United States to this day, and we have Donald J. Trump in office, but to this day, the White House is cognizant of the Irish dimension in the North, cognizant of the need to be accommodating of both Irish and British identities there, and cognizant that a single majoritarian attitude towards the North is not one that can function. History has told us this, and the United States presidencies have accepted that as a reality.
That's a thing, very good segue to today, in the sense that we heard from the Consul General from Ireland just now. She introduced the film, and very importantly, she outlined how the work of John Hume and the work of others that you've outlined was so significant to not just 20 years ago, but what is happening today. And what do you think John Hume in the film can teach us about what we're seeing today and the importance of the work, the continuing work of what John Hume and the others did?
I suppose there are two ways to look at that. One, through the lens of Ireland, because Hume's determination to forge a new political consciousness in Ireland really was the dominant theme of his whole life. And I'm saying life, not just political life. And the other lens is, you know, the broader view. What does this teach people in the United States? What does this teach people in France and Germany about how politics can work, or in Australia here? The first, I think, in the case of Ireland, the lessons of what John Hume stood for and the validity of his analysis is absolutely indispensable. Young Irish people do need to understand where he came from, how he arrived at this analysis, and they have to confront what I will call the validity of the analysis, or demonstrate a better analysis. But really, this is a person both in action and in deed and in thought, was a fundamental figure for change and change for the better in Ireland, and his political life stands as an example to many coming on, and particularly in Northern Ireland now, where you may or may not know the Assembly is currently suspended through political irresponsibility, through willful damage on the part of two parties which are particularly retrograde in nearly everything that they do, and particularly destructive of the Good Friday Agreement philosophy. So yes, the people have to learn in a way that those politicians, those two parties I mentioned, have failed to learn. As for the broader world, it's true that there are intricacies in this story that don't translate. I mean, it's not as though you just take this and bring it to Cyprus and then bring it onto the Balkans, and by the end of the week you're in Colombia and solving all the world problems. It's not like that. It doesn't pretend to be like that. But there is, at the heart of the film, an assertion of the necessity of a clear-headed approach to politics and the importance of learning from history. You know, the old adage and the old cliche that those who don't learn from their history are condemned to repeat it. And if it's a bloody awful history, as it has been in Northern Ireland, it's particularly one which you want to learn from and get the hell away from. So those people and those conflict zones I mentioned, and Middle East and so on, if they've got a takeaway from this film, I think it could be simply that for all the passion and the rhetoric surrounds violent methods, ultimately the conference table is what's required for a political, if you want to have a political settlement, you need to approach it through political means. Hume always, that was always his catch cry, and I think there's a takeaway there for everyone. And there's also, as I say, this lesson from history: look back and try to see that, see your current political reality in its historical trajectory. That to me is very important. As the maker of this film, I wanted to show what happened in the 1990s, not as a miraculous event, but rather as the culmination of a long and subtle build-up to political reconstruction. So I think there's a lot there for people they can glean a lot from that.
Couldn't agree more, and I do hope people see it. And I'm so glad you're here and that people have had an opportunity to see the film and will have an opportunity to see it in Australia. Maurice, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's Saturday night at the Irish Film Festival, and we've just seen the Australian premiere of the documentary No Stone Unturned. And we're here with the producer of the film, Trevor Burney. Trevor, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
So first of all, you've arrived in Sydney very recently. How are you enjoying your time?
Well, this is my first time in Sydney, and it's been fabulous. I've been in Australia once before, but only got as far as Adelaide. So getting into Sydney and taking a look around, I have to say it hasn't disappointed. It's been an amazing time. And this is a fantastic festival, I have to say. All the people who have volunteered and the people who are around and make this all happen, I have to say hats off to them. It's been fabulous. And I think for the film and for all of us who have been working on this for so long, I don't think the audiences really truly appreciate how much we are so thankful to come a huge distance, but to be able to spend some time in a cinema on a Saturday night watching a film with an audience like that who are so engaged and so wanting to talk about it and so wanting to hang around into the, you know, the later part of the evening just to talk about it. I mean, I have to say it's just fantastic. And so I've loved every minute of the time, I have to say, in Sydney, and I can't wait to come back.
That's fantastic. We'd love to have you back, and I've certainly enjoyed the festival too. Now, your film, No Stone Unturned, can you tell us about your documentary?
No Stone Unturned is about an horrific incident that happened back in 1994. And in the summer of 1994, there was, for the first time in many, many years, certainly in my lifetime, there was the beginning of there was an air of optimism. There was talk that there were going to be ceasefires and there was going to be the end of the conflict. And for those who had been born into conflict, as I was born into Northern Ireland at a time where the conflict was really getting going. So I knew nothing more than living in a conflict zone, knowing that people were dying day and daily. So at that point in the summer of 1994, there were two big things happening. One, there was this move towards a peace, but two, there was the World Cup was happening, the Soccer World Cup was happening in America, and the Republic of Ireland was the only team from what we call the home nations in Ireland that got to the World Cup. So everyone watched the World Cup in Northern Ireland, and on the 18th of June 1994, we all went out, and myself and my brother went out to a cricket club, believe it or not, in East Belfast to watch the Republic of Ireland taking on Italy. But that evening was clouded because we knew that 3 days previously, three members of a loyalist paramilitary organisation were shot dead in the streets of Belfast. And we knew going out that night, and the reason we went to a cricket club in East Belfast was because it was a very quiet little place away from the main roads. And we did that because we knew that loyalist paramilitaries, whenever they were attacked, they basically lashed out, and they would lash out against the softest of targets, and a bar full of supporters watching a soccer match was the softest of targets. So we knew that night that's what could happen. And shortly after the game was over, when the Republic of Ireland beat Italy 1-0, news started to come through that there had been an attack on this little rural pub, a little pub that's no bigger than, you know, a living room in many homes. It's tiny. It probably only take about 15 or 20 people in the pub to fill it. And what had happened is two gunmen appeared at the door. One of them had gone through the door and opened up with an automatic rifle, fired 39 shots, and six men died. All of them shot standing with their back to the door watching a soccer match. And one of the people who died was 87 years of age, Barney Green, smoking his pipe, watching the game, enjoying the atmosphere in this little tiny rural pub. You know, it isn't even a village, it's a crossroads. Lochan Island was the scene of this attack. Lochan Island isn't even a village, you couldn't call it a village, it's just a crossroads. It's got a church, it's got a pub, and that's it. You know, there isn't even a shop. You know, there's a shop some distance away, but there's no shop in it. And these six men died. And this film looks at that incident on that night, why it happened, how it happened, who are the suspects, and it also looks primarily at the cover-up of the police knowledge and understanding and their role and involvement with some of those who were involved in the attack. And what we peel back on is the collusion between the police force and the paramilitaries that were involved, and the fact that some of those that happened to be involved in the attack were also informants for the police, and had been informants prior to the attack. And so the police had knowledge of the people who were in the car that drove to that little pub to carry out this horrendous attack. And the film examines how that could have happened.
It certainly is a shocking event, and it's amazing how much new light the film sheds on the circumstances and the investigation and the many subsequent investigations by the Ombudsman and many others. Now, working with Alex Gibney on the film, who is a kind of acclaimed documentary filmmaker, it would have been quite the experience. I'm curious about working with Alex and how he also got involved in the project.
Well, Alex and I have known each other for several years. We met at the Galway Film Festival just after I think he'd won an Oscar for his incredible movie Taxi to the Dark Side. So we'd had this relationship, and we worked on a film together called Mea Maxima Culpa, which examined the child abuse within the institution of the Catholic Church. And it was during, or I think just shortly after we that film was premiered, that we began talking about this film. And so Alex and I have got to know each other over the several years. But I have to say that Alex came at this film with a real sense of determination, a real incredible zeal. He brought that external reference to this film, because in Northern Ireland, we've known and lived with these stories all our lives. Alex's ability to take what they call as a helicopter view above this story, to be able to bring all his experience as the master storyteller he is to the film, was both invigorating and challenging at the same time. Because Alex was coming in from a very different cultural perspective on what could be done in a film like this and what could not be done. We in Northern Ireland have come to an understanding of journalism and how far journalism can go. And what Alex Gibney did is sort of ripped up those understandings and the rule book and said, we're going to push this story as far as we possibly can. And I think that was that challenged us in a really positive way. But it wasn't easy, and thank God we had the relationship that we had that sustained us through it, because it was very tough, and this is a very tough film, and it was a very tough film to make, and but thank God we had the families of the Lochan Island massacre behind us and their lawyer Niall Murphy, and because of that support and because of their integrity and because of their determination to get to the truth and the full truth and the unvarnished truth, then we got to the film that we have, and we're very, very proud of it. And it's been a privilege to work with, you know, one of the finest documentarians of our time in Alex Gibney, and we're very proud of the fact that we brought the story to him, and he was prepared to make the film that he did.
I think you can be very proud of this. It's an amazing film, and I think it was a film that will and has made some waves. And certainly since the film has been screened at festivals and around the world, has there been any follow-on in terms of the investigation or the public understanding of what happened back in 1994 and bring the perpetrators to ultimate justice?
Well, the short answer is no, there hasn't. The issue is in Northern Ireland that there isn't either the political will nor the resources to go after, you know, the 3,000 unsolved murders out of the conflict. You know, 3,700 people died over the course of the conflict, and 3,000 of those murders remain unsolved. The police today have enough to deal with in terms of the day-to-day crime. They simply do not have the resources, and they don't have the resources because the British government don't want to give them the resources. The British government don't want to give them the resources because they don't want to upset the political ecology that we now have, the uneasy peace that we have in Northern Ireland. And if the police did start to go after the suspects or the killers in this case, well, then other families are going to expect them to do about their loved ones, and where does that end? And the police simply don't have the resources, and as I say, the British government are not going to give them the money or the finance or the political support to do that. However, what the police did do, which is interesting, is they did make a statement after the film was shown in Northern Ireland, and said that they wanted to launch a criminal investigation into the leaking of a document that we have in the film. Now, you know, you can imagine how the families felt about that. Here they had six men shot dead in cold blood, and the police's first statement was to say, oh, we're going to go after the journalists because they've got hold of a document. I think it was just, frankly, it was insulting and disgusting, that really what they were going to do is put, you know, the filmmakers under criminal investigation. And today we still remain under investigation in regards to this document that was sent to us, thank God, by somebody who was, I believe, well motivated, someone who could see that there was a shocking injustice, and that the families were not being given the full truth, and they were motivated to send that document to us. And if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be able to bring the detail that we were able to bring to the screen that you've witnessed tonight.
Well, Trevor, it's a remarkable film and a remarkable issue of ongoing concern. And thank you so much for all your hard work and for your time tonight and for your amazing contribution to the festival.
Thank you very much. It's been fantastic. Look forward to coming back.